he said to Audrey. Now Charlie pretty much had everyone's attention. No, Audrey said, crossing her arms. Excuse me, Charlie said. He got up, moved his chair, then got down on his knees and opened the door again.
Need a cheese, said the voice.
Charlie opened the door a couple of inches, reached in, grabbed something, and threw it. Go play! They could all hear the distinct sound of a tennis ball bouncing off surfaces and something scurrying after it, then nothing. There, Charlie said, getting back in his seat. He'll be fine. I have a basset hound, said Carrie Lang. Showing him my boobs doesn't really have much of an effect on him. Hmm, Audrey said. Go figure. She moved to the center of the floor. Okay, here's what I've been thinking about this new order. She paused a moment, seeing if they would let her out of further explanations about her dog training methods. Everyone appeared to be letting it go, and she felt loving kindness toward all of them. The universe seeks balance, order. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction, right? Audrey was suddenly grateful that Lily was out of the room. She was feeling somewhat vulnerable to sarcasm as she waded into this concept. Everyone waited. So, for every dark, there is a light. The wheels turn, the planets spin. The machine seeks and finds order. But the universe also oscillates, pulses, expands, and contracts. And I've lost all of you, haven't I? Pretty much, said Charlie. Now that it was out there, everyone agreed. Okay, let me come at it this way. The Book of Living and Dying, what you call the Tibetan Book of the Dead, talks about hundreds of demons and monsters that one will encounter on the journey from life to death and beyond. It describes them in detail, but warns not to be afraid, because they are all illusions, manifestations of human consciousness.
Like the Morrigan.
But they aren't an illusion, said Charlie. They are very real and deadly. They become real, Audrey said. The Big Book warns not to let souls fall into the hands of those from the underworld. But at one time, they weren't in the underworld, were they? Human souls empower them. They were part of someone's living religion. So was that bullheaded thing. So was or is this elegant death entity in the Buick. So are you guys, you death merchants. The Big Book is revised because things change, the rules change, and I don't think this whole system of moving souls from one life to the next has always been that way. Every supernatural entity is a projection of human consciousness, going back for, well, who knows how long, and any change is going to be countered, always has been. She looked around the room. Nobody?
We need to figure out what to do, said Rivera.
I don't think you can solve a problem if you don't know what it is, Inspector, said Audrey. I think that the order the universe found, for a time anyway, was this ridiculously complex system of souls transferring through objects. Maybe there was a wobble 1,000 years ago, and this is the universe trying to correct that. But now there's another wobble. Maybe when Sophie was born, somehow, as the Luminatus, there had to be a balance, so that horned death thing rose, and the hellhounds came to protect Sophie, and the Morrigan appeared to balance that. The whole conflict changed things, and for the last year, it has been seeking a new order. Subtle, like Mr. Baptiste, being able to sell souls over the internet instead of having a shop. Charlie said, but if Sophie was on the light side, and has lost her powers, and this new death has come, with the Morrigan, doesn't that mean that everything is out of balance again? Yes, Audrey said. It means we're in a wobble, and there's way too much on the dark side of the wobble. Something has to balance it out.
Some good guys? Said Charlie.
Not necessarily, said Audrey. There's order and disorder. We may not perceive whatever is balancing the dark as good. I'm just saying there has to be something to balance the dark, and if it's not Sophie, there's something else, some other being or force. So, Charlie said, you're saying that every god throughout history, every supernatural being ever, is a manifestation of the power of the human soul? Audrey shrugged.
The ghost thief, Lily said from the doorway. Everyone looked up at her. Mike Sullivan said that the ghost on the bridge told him we had to find the ghost thief.
Which is what? Said Rivera, starting to show some impatience now.
Lily held up the Emperor's journal. This is not a list of everyone who has died in the Bay Area, but it is a list of a lot of people who have died. Most, I confirmed. And so are all of your calendars. But none of the names on the Emperor's list are in any of your calendars, except those in Charlie and Rivera's calendars, and only Charlie's from the last year.
Which means?
It means that if your soul object was retrieved, your name isn't on the Emperor's list. And after all those death merchants were murdered, the list got a lot longer fast. It means that there are a shit ton of unretrieved souls. Souls out of order, floating around, or taken by another entity. If what Audrey says actually applies, if they gain their power from human souls, there's something very big and very scary that's been taking these souls. I think that's what Mike's ghost girl was calling the ghost thief.
You know this for a fact? Said Charlie.
No, Asher, I don't know anything for a fact. I'm just putting it together from what we know and what Audrey is saying. I'm saying there's a big hole in the system right now, and I'm calling that hole the ghost thief. Could be good, could be bad.
So there, said Rivera. What do we do?
Lily looked to Audrey.
All yours,
Audrey said. I think you need to carry on collecting soul vessels, getting them to new people. Keep as many as you can out of the hands of the underworlders.
The cycle of living and dying is the order the universe is seeking.
She paused, scanned faces, got nothing.
I think.
Maybe it's better to do it Mr. Baptiste's way, said Minty Fresh. Not have them in our shops. Put them somewhere out of the way, a vault or something. Sell them remotely over the internet.
My wife and I can sell them, said Baptiste. We would just need a photo of each vessel.
We could move them all to a vault somewhere, said Minty Fresh. Only go there to get the ones you will ship.
Rivera said,
That might keep the soul vessels out of their hands, but it does ignore the more immediate problem, which is when they come for the souls, they kill us. Does no one else find that a problem?
Yeah, said Minty Fresh.
That's why I'm suggesting we hide the objects. Then we hide.
Stay out of our shops. Just go out to retrieve the new vessels. What do you want to do about it?
Go after them, said Rivera.
Sure, we try to figure out who this ghost thief is, and I'll use what resources I can to help, but the Morrigan requires a little more direct action.
We know they can be hurt by weapons, and they only get stronger as they accumulate human souls, so the sooner we go after them, the better chance we have of stopping them.
He looked at Charlie.
You need to figure out if your little girl still has her powers, because if she doesn't, her history with them is probably all that's protecting her, and without her hellhounds, that's about it. So even if we can't kill them, we can at least weaken them, slow them down.
Minty Fresh rubbed his shaved head, as if polishing an idea in there, then looked at Charlie.
How did you find them last time?
Bummer found them. Charlie said. I sort of wandered around in the sewers with the squirrel people until we ran into Bummer. He led us to them.
They're definitely going to be out of the light, Lily said.
We heard one, the inspector and I, in a sewer in the sunset, said Baptiste.
That's my neighborhood, said Lily.
I'm officially pro-fuck-up-the-sewer-harpies shit. Now you just have to find them.
The Emperor held up a hand. I know where they are.
Okay, well, that was easy, said Lily.
You don't know where the thousands of souls listed in your book are, do you?
The old man shook his head dolefully.
I'm sorry.
Baptiste thought it was perhaps the strangest meeting he had ever attended, and even when it was over and they were all leaving, he looked to Minty Fresh and said,
Mr. Fresh, can you tell me, please, what happened just now?
You know in a horror movie when the scientist comes in and explains that there's a zombie virus or there are vampires in the city?
Yes.
That's what this was. But instead of a scientist, we had a crazy old man who thinks he's the Emperor of San Francisco.
Oh,
I see, said Baptiste, who really didn't see. He stood on the porch of the big Victorian, gathering his thoughts, searching in his messenger bag for his car keys as the others made their way to the street.
Psst!
A noise at his feet. No, below his feet. It was coming from beside the stairs.
Monsieur Baptiste!
An urgent, small whisper. Baptiste went to the rail and looked over. Below on the walk stood a creature about 14 inches tall with a rotund little body, small hands that looked like those of a raccoon, and the head of a calico cat, wearing what looked like miniature pink hospital scrubs and doll shoes.
Monsieur Baptiste, comment allez-vous?
It said in perfect French.
Not so good, said Baptiste.
Part 3. Cry woe, destruction, ruin, and decay. The worst is death, and death will have his day. William Shakespeare, Richard II, Act 3, Scene 2. Chapter 19. Wiggly Charlie's Adventure. Wiggly Charlie lived in a big house with his friends Audrey and Big Charlie. He liked mozzarella cheese sticks, chasing his tennis ball, and putting his purple wizard hat on his willy and pretending they were friends. One day, he was playing with his ball in the butler's pantry, which was a small room where rich people used to keep their prisoners until they needed them to bring them a beverage. When Big Charlie reached in the door, took the ball, and threw it for Wiggly Charlie, it bounced into a vent behind the wastebasket and disappeared. Wiggly Charlie didn't even take time to be sad or think how throwing his ball down a vent was kind of a dick move, but instead jumped right into the vent after it. He slid down and down and plopped out on his bottom in the dirt. All around him were little lights in many colors. He stood up and turned all around, looking up at all the pretty colors. He saw that there was a little doorway, just his size, and on the other side he could see his ball. He went through the doorway and found himself in a passageway made of green glass, so he could still see the colored lights attached to the floor joists of the big house, as well as others that were strung through the glass hallway. He threw his ball and chased it down the hallway, catching it in his mouth just as it was about to roll down some stairs. Then he saw something wonderful. In front of him was a big round room, like a hole, only nicer, and all around it were little people, just like him. He dripped drool on his toes as he looked around in wonder at all the little people, all with different heads and feet, different hands and different clothes, all just about his size. They gathered around a stage in the center of the round room as one of them talked at the others.
"Bring the head for Thebe!"
said the little person on the stage. He was wearing a red uniform, had a face that looked like a cat skull, and a very nice black and red hat. When he talked, he waved around a spoon that was a fork, or a fork that was a spoon, whatever it was. Wiggly Charlie thought it was very clever. The little people parted, and two of them carried a tray with the head of an animal Wiggly Charlie didn't recognize down an aisle. It was the head of a possum, but the O was silent, as often happens with the decapitated. The red suit guy took the head and put it on a table on the stage.
"Bring the body for Thebe! Bring the body for Thebe!"
everyone chanted, and two more little people brought a big piece of meat on a tray and fitted it on the table with the head.
"Bring the legs for Thebe!"
and the legs were brought.
"Bring the voice!"
As each pair of little people brought their pieces, they took tools out of little pouches and sewed the pieces on the body. When the arms were attached, a person with a lizard face wearing a pretty pink dress brought some clothes, and the new body on the stage was dressed. Wiggly Charlie had seen Audrey making clothes just like the ones they fitted onto the body. These must be Audrey's secret friends, thought Wiggly Charlie.
"Bring the soul, so Thebe the Wise may give it life!"
said the special fork spoon guy.
"Bring the soul! Bring the soul! Bring the soul!"
There were many, many little people in the round room now, more than 100. But Wiggly Charlie didn't count very well, so he just thought there were many, many, Each of them had a red light in his or her chest, glowing even through their clothes. Now they opened two doors in the side of the round room, and behind it were many different kinds of objects: shoes, trophies, boxes, tools, bowls, rings, clocks, radios. There were many, many things, and each of them glowed a dull red, just like the little lights each of the little people had in his chest.
Bonjour,
said a voice right next to Wiggly Charlie, and he was so surprised that he dropped his ball. It bounced down the steps and into the crowd of little people. He looked to where the voice had come from, and he saw the very pretty face of a calico cat.
Soyez la bienvenue, she said.
She had a pink ribbon around her neck and wore a pink outfit like the ones Audrey made. In the center of her chest, a red light glowed very brightly, and Wiggly Charlie jumped and clicked his talons because he liked it so much.
Shh, said the cat person.
She held a finger to her mouth, which Wiggly Charlie knew meant he should be quiet, because Audrey and Big Charlie did it all the time. She pointed to the middle of the big room, then patted a spot next to her on the stairs for him to sit next to her. He did, and watched.
Je m'appelle Hélène,
said the cat person. Wiggly Charlie didn't know what kind of nonsense she was talking about, but she was nice, so he sat down and watched the show going on in the middle of the big round room.
Ball,
he said on the stairs for him to sit next to her. He did, and watched.
Je m'appelle Hélène,
said the cat person. Wiggly Charlie didn't know what kind of nonsense she was talking about, but she was nice, so he sat down and watched the show going on in the middle of the big round room.
Ball,
he said, pointing to the spot in the crowd where he thought his ball might have rolled. A radio was brought on the stage and set beside the body they had stitched together. The fellow in red raised his fork spoon and said,
Now, Thieb the Wise will bring life to one of the people.
The crowd chanted,
Thieb the Wise! Thieb the Wise! Thieb the Wise!
Not everyone could say the words, and some just growled in rhythm or stamped their feet.
Thieb the Wise! Thieb the Wise! Thieb the Wise!
Spoonfork Guy took papers from his red coat and spread them out on the stage, then started to chant in a different language. Wiggly Charlie had seen pages like that in Audrey's book room, and he knew that you were not supposed to lick or chew or drool on them. But what he didn't know was that these were very special pages that had been given to Audrey by the High Lama of her monastery in Tibet, and she should have probably not left them lying around like she did with most of her things, because she was still not good with having things. Anyway, the spoon-fork guy chanted and chanted, and before long, the light in the radio moved through the air and settled in the chest of the body they had stitched together, and everyone said, Ooh, and Ah, unless they couldn't talk, then mostly they just hissed or clicked. But when the light had moved, the body twitched. It twitched again. The spoon-fork guy stopped chanting, stood over the body, and said,
He's alive! Alive!
Everyone chanted, and Wiggly Charlie bounced up and down and made his most excited sound and clicked his talons because everything was so wonderful and everyone was just his size.
Alive!
Everyone said, and the body sat up. The new little person looked around. Wiggly Charlie jumped to his feet, and as he chanted with the others, he bounced down the stairs, clicking his talons.
Alive! Alive! Alive!
The spoon-fork guy lowered his fork spoon, and everybody stopped chanting.
Alive! Alive! Alive!
Wiggly Charlie chanted on, and everyone turned and looked to him, even the new person. So Wiggly Charlie chanted much quieter and stopped on the stairs halfway down.
Not one of us,
said the spoon-fork guy, pointing his spoon-fork at Wiggly Charlie.
Not one of us! Not one of us! Not one of us!
They all chanted and pointed.
Not one of us! Not one of us! Not one of us!
Chanted Wiggly Charlie, glad that he wasn't chanting by himself anymore. The spoon-fork guy came off the stage, and the crowd opened up for him as he passed through and came up the stairs until he was standing right in front of Wiggly Charlie.
Thieb the Wise demands silence!
Shouted the spoon-fork guy.
Not one of us! Not one of us! Not one of us!
Chanted Wiggly Charlie, the rest of the crowd leaving him hanging. Finally, he trailed off and looked around, hoping someone else had been chanting, but they hadn't.
I am Thieb the Wise, said the spoon fork guy.
He pointed to his red coat with the shiny gold buttons.
Steve,
said Wiggly Charlie.
No, Thieb, said Thieb. I did not know who I was, but now I have remembered. I am the leader of the people. I am Thieb.
Steve,
said Wiggly Charlie.
Steve, Steve, Steve,
chanted the crowd.
No, shouted Thieb. She put our souls in these vessels, and they gave us false names. I was called Bob then, but our real names have come back to us. We remember.
Steve! 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 Chanted the crowd.
No, you dumb fucks!
Shouted Thieb, although he didn't look as sure of himself as when he had started.
You are not one of us. You are not one of the people. You are incomplete.
He pointed to the little light in his own chest, then at the enormous pile of things that were red.
You are missing something. Need a cheese,
said Wiggly Charlie.
Need a cheese, need a cheese, need a cheese,
chanted the people. Thieb bellowed.
She gave us hideous form and no memory, but now we have memory.
Need a cheese, need a cheese, need a cheese.
Shut up,
shouted Thieb, and the crowd did.
She gave us no voices, but the new people have voices.
Need a cheese, need a cheese, need a cheese.
She gave us no lips, but we have grown lips, said Thieb.
Lips, lips, lips,
the people chanted.
Lips,
said Wiggly Charlie, handing Thieb his enormous dong, which Thieb the Wise wisely let drop to the ground.
Sure, you have that, because you are her favorite, but you have no soul.
Lips,
said Wiggly Charlie.
We were people, and she trapped us in these hideous creatures, but we have her books, and using them, we have become more. There will be more of us, thousands of us, and the people shall all have voices, all shall have lips. So saith Thieb the Wise.
Steve the Wise, Steve the Wise, Steve the Wise,
everyone, including Wiggly Charlie, chanted. Thieb the Wise was not pleased, for he was pretty sure his name as a human had been Thieb, not Steve. But then, Steve really did make quite a bit more sense, didn't it? Now he was angry.
Guards!
Called Thieb, possibly Steve, previously Bob. Four of the people, all wearing the new colored cotton outfits that Audrey had sewn, came out from behind all the soul vessels. Each carried a different weapon, a knife, a hatchet, a sickle, and a screwdriver. Although not a spork, for the spork of power was reserved only for Thieb the Wise. Each also wore a little belt, more crudely fashioned than their clothes, and tucked in it were canisters of pepper spray.
Seize him,
said Thieb.
Seize him, seize him, seize him,
chanted the people.
You don't have to chant that,
shouted Thieb. And they pretty much fell silent, but for a few stragglers, who were still working the lips chant and were behind. The guards took Wiggly Charlie by the arms, and he let them, asking each of them if they might have a mozzarella stick handy, using the traditional,
need a cheese phrase.
You, her soulless minion, have been sent to us as a sign, Charlie Asher. We will take Audrey's soul and put it in your soulless body, so she, too, will know what it is to be trapped in a hideous little creature.
Thieb waved his spork maniacally and laughed. Wiggly Charlie struggled, and two more guards came and grabbed his feet. Audrey gave him cheeses, and had boobies, and other parts that made him sleepy. He didn't want them to hurt her.
Take him away, said Thieb. Tie him up, and prepare to seize the heretic maker, Audrey!
Tie him up, tie him up, tie him up,
chanted the people, although to be honest, most of them weren't sure what was going on. The guards dragged Wiggly Charlie out of the big round room.
Mon Dieu!
Said the cat person called Helen, who was still at the top of the stairs. She hurried off the other way to the passageway that led out under the porch. Chapter 20 Testing, Testing. On his first day back, living in his old building, Charlie picked Sophie up at school and walked her to get ice cream. On their way home, cones in hand, they encountered a rat that was dying in the gutter, probably from poison. Charlie thought, a dead rat. Well, that would be disgusting and cliche, but an almost dead rat, that, sir, is an opportunity. Charlie looked around. He didn't see anyone else out walking on this particular stretch of street, at least none close enough to tell what he was doing. He didn't notice the yellow Buick Roadmaster parked on the next block, someone sitting behind the wheel. Sophie, honey, you know the word that you're never supposed to say and that thing you're never supposed to ever do? Yep, she nodded, plowing a nose-shaped furrow into her orange sherbet. Okay. I need you to do that. With this rat. You said never, ever! I know, honey, but this creature is suffering, so this would help it. Audrey said that life is suffering. You can't listen to her. She's a crazy woman. No, I need you to try it. Just point at the rat and say the word. Okay, Sophie said. Hold this. She handed Charlie her cone and crouched down. She pointed to the rat, looked over her shoulder at Charlie just to make sure, and he nodded. Kitty, she said. Lily was sitting at her call station, headset on, tablet before her, watching a French film about a man who goes insane when he shaves off his mustache, when her line rang. She could see on the terminal that it was one of the hard lines from the Golden Gate Bridge. She paused her movie, took a deep breath, and connected. Crisis hotline, this is Lily. What's your name? Hi, Lily. This is Mike Sullivan. Hi, Mike. How are you doing today? Lily, this is Mike Sullivan. The Mike Sullivan who jumped? Lily stopped breathing for a second. No one who had actually jumped had called back before. She wasn't sure she was trained for this. Sure, she would have ignored the training, but it would be nice to have it to fall back on. So, Mike, it says here you're on the bridge, on one of the hard lines. Yes, I'm just sort of connected. I don't know how. So you're not, like, standing there talking into the speaker box or anything? No, nothing like that. I'm just sort of here. Not physically, but it feels like I'm talking to you. You're calling from the other side? Lily said. What, Marin? No, right on the bridge. It is you! His doofuscosity had transcended even death. I'm here, Lily, on the bridge, like Concepcion promised, like I thought it would be. Well, not like I thought it would be, but I'm here. So it worked? Did Charlie get my body? Yes, but that was a while ago. Do you not have the same perception of time? It did seem to take a long time to figure out how to get through to you. I tried asking people on the bridge, even risked going to one of my old co-workers. Nothing. I don't have whatever it is that Concepcion and the others had to appear to me. Maybe it was you, said Lily, not them. Really? You're talking to me from beyond the grave, although not literally. A lot of people have been on that bridge over the last 75 years, yet you're the one she picked. Oh, yeah. How's your friend doing with my body? He seems pretty comfortable. He's boning a nun with it. Oh, no. No, it's okay. She's into it. You met her. Oh, Audrey? Yes. So, what's it like being dead? Lily was suddenly aware of the other counselors in the room looking at her, which normally didn't bother her. Sage was writing down the time on a post-it, no doubt so she could find the call on the recordings when she reported Lily. Just a second, Mike. She'd forgotten for a moment that all the calls were being recorded. She pressed the mute key and turned to Sage. This guy thinks he's a ghost, she said. I just need to indulge his delusions long enough to figure out how to get him down. You want to take over? I can put him on hold, probably. No, go ahead, said Sage. Sorry. I'm back, Mike. You okay? One of my co-counselors was noting the time for the recording. Recording? That's not good, is it? I just need to get you safely off that bridge, Mike, she said, louder than was necessary. Well, I just called to tell you that I was okay. Better than okay. I'm not just the me you've met. I'm a lot of people. And there are others here. Thousands. Mike, as a trained crisis counselor, I'm not qualified or authorized to give you a diagnosis. But if someone less grounded than you were to say that he was a lot of people, then I would have to recommend he seek counseling. Isn't that what I'm doing? Not really a mystery that you didn't have any friends in life, Mike. Oh, the recording, right. I need to know if you guys found the ghost thief yet. Concepcion says we need to hurry. Not yet, Mike. We're trying to figure that one out. Oh, okay. Thanks. Keep trying. I guess I won't jump today, Lily. You've changed my outlook. I'm going to go seek some counseling right now. He was possibly the worst liar she'd ever heard. Wait, Mike! He disconnected. Lily looked over her shoulder to see if Sage was still listening. But the frizzy-haired trader in cargo pants was already on her way to the director's office. Well, she's totally useless, Charlie said as he entered the apartment. Sophie ran by him into the apartment, wailing like a tiny fire engine, through the great room where Jane and Cassie were sitting, and into her room. She slammed the door. Jane sat up, wine glass in hand. I'm suddenly feeling a lot better about my parenting skills. Sophie opened her door and poked her head out.
I liked you better when you were dead,
she shouted at Charlie. She slammed the door again.
So, good first day back? Asked Cassie.
Charlie plopped down on the couch next to his sister. She can't even kill a rat that's already circling the drain. In fact, I think he perked up a little. She kept pointing and saying, kitty, 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 but nothing happened. A couple walking down the other side of the street gave me smiling pity nods because they thought she was slow.
You're not supposed to say slow, said Cassie. It's unkind, although Jane always says it.
That's because she takes like an hour to vacuum the living room, not the developmentally kind of slow.
Unkind, said Cassie.
Charlie scooted away from Jane on the couch. You make a 7-year-old vacuum the living room? That's horrible. You're like a wicked stepmother. First, I pay that child a living wage. Second, the reason it takes her so long is because she gets to do whatever she wants during the process. And third, she wants to be a princess. So a wicked stepmother is like a prereq.
Well, she's not going to be a princess. She's not even the Luminatus anymore.
You told her she isn't the Luminatus?
Well, of course. I need to keep her safe.
Jane wouldn't even tell her that she wasn't a vegan, said Cassie.
It's not a diet thing, said Jane. She really wants to fit in.
But she's not a vegan, right? Charlie said. Lily said you told her she could eat animals that only eat vegetables.
Yeah, that's when she was a vegetarian. Now that she's a vegan, she only eats orange food, mac and cheese, carrots, sweet and sour pork.
Sweet and sour pork is not vegan. The kid had 2 dogs the size of cows at her command. If she wants sweet and sour pork to be vegan, then it is.
So you just let her do whatever she wants, run around here like a crazed barbarian?
She likes to think of herself as a warrior princess, said Cassie.
Are you guys fighting? Charlie asked.
It's how we show affection, said Cassie.
Honestly, I'm kind of sad she's not the Luminatus, said Jane, slouching on the couch. I feel bad for her. Plus, it really got me through discussions in line at Whole Foods. When the other mothers were going on about how awesome their kids were, I'd think, oh, your little Riley is an all-star in youth soccer, can play Bach on the cello, speaks Mandarin, and has a brown belt in ballet. Well, Sophie is the Luminatus. Death! The Grim Reaper. The Big D. She rules the underworld and can vaporize demons with a wave of a hand. She's guarded by indestructible hellhounds that can eat steel and burp fire. So your little Riley can lick dog drool off my Sophie's spiky red Louboutins, bitch.
Now I'll never be able to say that.
Sophie has spiky red Louboutins? Charlie said. I don't think those are good for a kid's posture.
No, I was embellishing. Really not the point of the speech, Chuck. It was that Sophie had a thing, but it had to be a secret.
They're all so gifted.
Jane said gifted with a tone normally reserved for reference to skin-boring parasites.
You know one mother has her kid in ninjutsu?
Ninja lessons! Kid is 7! Why does she need invisible assassin skills?
Well, as important as your self-esteem in line at Whole Foods is, I'm more concerned that if she doesn't have her powers, with the hellhounds gone, we don't have any way to protect her from, you know. Cassie and Jane both knew how Cavuto had been killed. They played darting eye tennis between them until Cassie lost and so had to say something positive. Maybe she's just having a hiatus or something. She had them when she needed them, right? Well, maybe her powers will return. Like when she hits puberty. Maybe one day when she's in sixth or seventh grade, she'll get her period. The skies will darken and the apocalypse will be on. That's how it happened for me, said Jane. It did not, said Charlie. I don't remember that. You were at camp. Well, even if that's the case, we need to get her to sixth or seventh grade. Look, I need you guys to take her somewhere out of the city until this is all sorted out. I can't. I have work, said Jane. You're sitting around drinking wine at 3 p.m. on a Monday. If you give me a day, said Cassie, I'll get my classes covered. How far do you think we should go, and how long do you need us to stay away? Thanks, Cass, Charlie said. I think maybe a day's drive will do it. Whatever is going on, it's clearly centered in the city. The others are talking about going after the Morgan. I'll ask them to wait until you're safely out of town. Done, said Cassie. It's sad that your best sister is not related to you by blood. I was going to do it, said Jane. I just wanted to make a bigger deal out of it. Why is all this centered in San Francisco? Cassie asked. Seems like it should be a worldwide thing, right? Did you guys figure that out in your meeting? I suppose that's something we should have talked about, said Charlie. When Mike Sullivan first stepped into space, into Concepcion's arms, he was surprised not only that it didn't hurt, but just how completely joyful he felt.
My beautiful Nikolai, Concepcion said.
You said that before, Mike said, but I'm not. Then he felt it. The thread of time, going back from the bridge, through a dozen lives in a dozen times, men, women, births, deaths, strung out like lights, the brightest, the Russian, the Count, Nikolai Rezanov, made radiant because of the light of Concepcion de Arguello, his love. He kissed her, as he perceived that he could kiss her, because the boundaries of their bodies no longer existed, and they were, for a moment, completely and absolutely one. But she pulled away, and again he could see her, and she him.
Not yet, she said.
No, but you waited so long.
I had to wait, but I was happy to wait. I could do nothing but wait. And I can wait a little more, then?
So you had to find me before you could rest?
Rest? Oh, no, my love. We will be together at last, but it will not be to rest. Look at them. Feel them. All of these ghosts.
Mike looked, then reached out, aware of every strand and rivet of the bridge, and the ghosts that flowed over and through them, over and through one another, oblivious. The bridge their only anchor to any world.
There is much to do, said Concepcion.
I can feel that, said Mike, feeling the tug of the thread of his past lives like fish on a long line.
And they, and many more than them, are trapped if we do not find the ghost thief.
Did you look under the couch? Mike said. In my many lives, I remember that the lost things are often...
You fell off a fucking horse?
Said Concepcion, the spell between them broken for now.
You couldn't have told someone to send a word? A note?
The Morrigan were gathered at a sewer junction under Mission Street, staying pressed against the walls, flat as shadows, to avoid the light filtering down from a grate above. Babbed was manifesting a slight, blue-black, feathered pattern on her body, while her sisters were merely flat masses of darkness. Babbed had managed to snag one of the little creatures who carried human souls, souls that they could consume, as they once consumed the souls of dead warriors on the battlefield in the days when they had ruled as goddesses. She ate it in front of her sisters as it squealed, and they watched jealously as the feathers appeared on her with the power in the soul.
When she had consumed all but a few gooey drops of the red soul, she threw them each one of the creature's legs, which they sucked out of the air, like groupers snapping down fry. Babbed speared the piece of meat the creature had been carrying, bit into it, then spit it out in revulsion.
"Just meat," she said. "Ham, I think." "I thought we liked ham," said Nemain,
looking enviously at her sister's talons, which had manifested with the power of the soul she'd just consumed.
"These things holding the souls, aren't they made of ham?" asked Macha.
She very much wanted to pick up the little creature's head, which lay in a stream of water in the pipe, but didn't have the corporeal substance to pick up and hold anything. It would make a lovely pendant, at least until she could get a human head to replace it, which was her preference.
"No, it's just meat," said Babbed, "but they are gathering it for something. Maybe they have a nest."
"A nest?" said Macha, a dreamy tone to her voice. "A nest built with bones of men, lamps of skulls all around."
"And cushions," said Nemain, joining in the reverie, "to lie on. To push a dying warrior down on and fuck him to death," said Babbed. "Lick his soul from your claws as his light goes out," said Macha, shuddering at the pleasure of the thought. "Ooh, a nest," said Nemain. "We should go back to the tunnel near the fort, for when Yama brings us the souls." "No, we should wait for more of these things," said Babbed, pointing to the skull. "Follow them to their nests." "With the souls we get from Yama, we can go above," said Macha. "Above, find the soul sellers, grow stronger, hold dominion, build a nest." "With cushions," added Nemain.
"I don't trust Yama,"
said Babbed, emboldened by her easy soul score.
"The last time, the banshee." "And the gong," said Macha.
"And the way he walks in the light," said Nemain. "How does he do that?"
"Shh," shushed Babbed. There were voices in the pipes, not filtering down from above, but in the pipes with them, small voices. She bridged herself over the top of the pipe, disappearing into the darkness there as best she could, fighting the form she had gained. Her sisters moved away from the grate above and became part of the darkness once again. The procession of creatures moved by them, perhaps 10 of them, each with the little light showing through his clothes, each carrying some bit of meat or animal part, except the last, who carried what looked like a porcelain candy dish that also glowed with the light of a human soul. The Morrigan followed them for blocks, flowing along the sides of the pipes, watching as the little creatures climbed a makeshift ladder and hopped one by one through an open storm grate. Babbed moved to look out, but the daylight singed her, and she pulled back.
"Wait,"
she said. When darkness fell an hour later, they gathered at the storm grate and looked out.
"I remember this place," said Nemain.
"That tall green one kept running over us here," said Macha. "Cars suck."
Babbed rose up, spotted a very large Victorian house across the street, a sign in front that she could not read.
"What is it?"
asked Nemain.
"The nest," said Babbed.
The director messaged Lily to see him in his office when her shift was finished. She set an alarm on her phone that would go off 5 minutes into her appearance and would sound like a phone call. The door was open, and she could hear Mr. Leonidas and Sage talking. She listened long enough to determine they weren't talking about her, then knocked. "Come in," Leonidas said. He was dark and a little doughy, with eyebrows that Lily found it hard to look away from because they really looked like they might have ideas of their own. Because of her fascination with his eyebrows, Leonidas thought that Lily paid rapt attention to everything he said and consequently showed her favor over the other counselors. Leonidas had a background in psychology and public health, so being a snarky bitch around him was deeply unsatisfying because he would always try to find the root of her discontent, the hurt behind her hostility. Getting a rise out of him was like trying to give a hand job to a parking meter.
you were going to end up frustrated and exhausted long before a cop came along to haul you away. In spite of herself, she kind of liked Leonidas. Having Sage in the room, the enemy, was presenting a dilemma.
"Mr. Leonidas," Lily said, "what can I do for you? I can wait until you're done with Sage if you'd like."
"No, please, have a seat. Sage brought something to my attention, and I thought it fair that she'd be here to see how it was handled."
"Oh, right," said Lily. "For her thesis, sure."
She sat down, looked over the array of a dozen or so family pictures propped across Leonidas' desk.
"How's the fam? Have any more kids?"
"No, still just the 6, same as when you asked me 2 weeks ago."
"Well, I know how busy you are," Lily said. "What's up?"
"Lily, Sage heard some disturbing dialogue in the call center today, and I thought we would all listen to the recording together so we could understand what happened."
"I don't see what she has..."
Leonidas held up his hand to stop her right there. "Let's just listen." He hit a key on his PC keyboard, and Lily heard her own voice coming out of the speakers. Sage sat back and nodded, as if she just wrapped the big case on Law and Order.
"Crisis Center, this is Lily. What's your name?"
And there was silence. Nothing.
"Hi, Mike," Lily's voice said on the recording. "How are you doing today?"
And there was another gap, and Lily's voice continued, her entire half of the conversation, and only her half. And as the recording ran, Sage started to squirm in her chair, and Lily fought very hard not to grin, and was really thankful when the alarm on her phone went off so she could make a big deal out of ignoring the imaginary call. They listened to the entire conversation. Lily sighed only. When it ended, Leonidas looked at Sage and said, "That's it. That's the entire call."
"But she always does..." Sage stopped. "I've heard her before. She's so profane."
"I think we can see what was going on here," Leonidas said. He raised his eyebrows at Sage in what he probably thought was an open, understanding manner, but Lily thought they looked like two bristly caterpillars crouching, ready to pounce. He turned to Lily, and she pushed back a little from his desk. The eyebrows, they were sizing her up.
"Lily, while I don't approve of hijinks in the call center, I understand the point you were making with this little performance."
Thanks, Mr. Leonidas," Lily said.
"Point them at Sage. Point them at Sage."
"And Sage, while you may not immediately see the efficacy of Lily's method, she does get results. She connects with the clients, and ultimately, that saves lives. Perhaps less focus on her process and more on yours, and we'll be able to connect with more people. Help more people. Don't you agree?"
Sage nodded, looking into the abyss of one of the buttons on her cargo pants.
It was a Leonidas ass-chewing, as close as he ever got to one. Lily resisted doing a booty dance of triumph against Sage's stupid sweater, because that would be immature, so she did it mentally and said,
"Friends?"
She stood and held out her arms to force Sage into hugging it out, and as she held Sage a little too long, feeling the slight woman get tenser and tenser as the embrace continued, even as she puffed Sage's frizzy-ass hair out of her mouth, exhibiting her victory, nay, her domination, Lily also warmed with the satisfaction of her own specialness. She was the only one who could hear him, the only one who could talk to the ghost of the bridge.
Chapter 21. Killing Villarreal. Mike Sullivan hung from one of the vertical suspension cables by one hand.
"Look, I'm as light as a feather. There's hardly even a breeze, and I'm standing straight out."
"You are lighter than a feather, my love. Let go, and you will not fall, and the bridge will not let you blow away."
"Yeah, I think I'm going to wait on the letting go part."
"You are beyond fear, and you are bound to the bridge, just as you are drawn to it."
"Just the same, you died of what, diphtheria? What if right after you died I was to offer you a big steaming cup of diphtheria? How would you feel?"
"They can put it in a cup now. It was invisible in my day."
"A Cleveland steamer was a ship in your day, my sweet Conchita."
She reclined on the ocean side railing. The walkway on that side of the bridge was closed most of the time. The foot and bicycle traffic confined to the bayside. Not that it would have mattered. People would have walked right through her and have only felt a chill, which was normal for the Golden Gate. She said,
"There is someone who needs to speak to you, my love."
"Another one? I don't understand. Why do they want to talk to me?" There had been scores of them, each telling a different story. A woman who was trapped overnight in a stationery cabinet with a janitor after the earthquake of 1989 and didn't share the Pepsi she had in her purse. A man who hallucinated he was being pursued by a giant squirrel in John Muir Woods. The only thing the stories had in common was some unresolved element, some lesson unlearned, something sad.
"I don't know why, my love, any more than I know why I had to wait 200 years for you, and that you have been on your way here for 200 years. But I trust there is a reason. I have faith."
"Faith? But all those years as a nun, didn't you? I mean, did it prepare you for this?"
"For this? No. True devotion is done not for a reward, but for the devotion itself. All my works, all my prayers, were for forgiveness of my selfishness, my weakness, because I could never love God as much as I loved you. What my time as a nun prepared me for was the damnation of being without you for these centuries, which I deserved. For this, you, here, with me, this joy, for this I was not prepared."
Mike settled on the walkway beside her and took her in his arms. She embraced him, and in an instant, they were a single entity. The only thing the third ghost could see of them was a white gardenia that Concepcion wore in her hair, glowing.
"This is where I'm supposed to talk to the guy, right?" said the third ghost.
Mike and Concepcion divided, like a luminous amoeba, and each stood on the walkway.
"My love, I am going to drift," she said. "Good day, sir."
The third ghost, who wore a baseball uniform, tipped his cap.
"She asks someone what a Cleveland steamer is, might be your last, whatever that was you two were doing for a while."
"You heard that?" asked Mike.
"Yep. You want to have a smoke or something?"
"I'm good. How long have you been there?"
"A while. You don't get many conversations here, as you probably know. Most people are kind of flighty."
"Good description."
"Besides, I wanted to see what happened if things got hot. Never seen that before, either."
"How long you been on the bridge?"
Not long. 10, maybe 15 years. Hard to say exactly. Time, right?"
"Do you know why you're here? I mean, any of us, but let's just say you."
"Cursed, I guess," said the ball player. "Cursed long before I took the last out."
"Yeah?" said Mike. "Tell me.
You a baseball fan?"
"I watch the game now and then."
"So you heard of Skipper Nelson, Giants shortstop, right?"
"Nope," Mike said. "Sorry."
"So I'll start where it started," said Skipper. "I used to think I was cursed because of the bird, but now that I've thought about it, it was probably because I planned the murder of Villarreal. I first ran across Villarreal in the minors, before the bird, so it was probably him. Probably. I was drafted as a shortstop right out of high school by the Giants and sent to their double-A team in Richmond, Virginia, the Flying Squirrels, which is where I got my nickname, the Squirrel. When I finally got sent up to the majors, because of the way I could track down a grounder and turn double plays, like a squirrel after a nut, the announcer says, and it sticks. It could have been worse, though. I could have gone to the Grand Chute Crotch Crickets, and then had to deal with that nickname for my whole career. A year after me, Villarreal was drafted out of the Dominican League to the Chattanooga Lookouts, which were the double-A club for the Dodgers. A catcher, switch hitter, batted .325 in the Dominican, arm like a cannon. He was an early draft pick, so you knew he wouldn't be in double-A ball for long. But a butterball. 5'9", 250. You could time his 40-yard dash with a sundial.
So the Dodgers wanted to see if they could take some weight off him and give him a little more speed on the bases. First time I meet him, he's catching for a one-pitch lefty named Markley. One of those guys you see a lot in the minors. Scary heat, pushing 100 miles an hour, but no movement. A laser beam. You know, if it's going to be over, it's going to be right at your knees, in the middle of the plate. Then, after about 8 pitches, he's going to be spraying deadly leather all over the goddamn place. So, if you can avoid getting a burning, baseball-sized hole through your body somewhere, you draw a walk. One out. Guy before me whiffs so bad, I can feel the wind off his bat in the on-deck circle. But I'm not worried. I can see heat. It's a gift. Then, as I'm walking up, before I even get in the batter's box, Villarreal starts talking.
How'd you doing? Nice to meet you. Are you married? Got any kids? How's your mother? How was the bus trip? You guys staying at the travel lodge? How's the rooms? You got a mini fridge?
And he just keeps talking. Mostly questions. For the next 15 fucking years. But I don't know that. Right then, I know, absolutely know, I can hit Markley before he goes all wild thing on me. I just have to watch one go by to measure. But I'm listening to Villarreal the whole time. And I whiff. And so it begins. Fortunately, that first one was an exhibition game, so we don't play Chattanooga again. Before I get brought to the bigs the next year, when the Giants' starting shortstop is trying to turn a double play and gets a knee bent back by a sliding base runner. Already I have a reputation as being nimble on the turn, and no matter what the odds of it happening twice in a season, a ball club loses a starter to a certain kind of injury, they want to avoid it happening again. So I get the nod instead of the shortstop at Fresno, who has a better batting average than me, but can be flat-footed at times. Villarreal gets called up by the Dodgers the same season, backup catcher, because their starter is taking a lot of shots to the head and is kind of goofy. In those days, before the concussion rules, if a guy could count to 10 and tell his left from his right, he was good to play. And to be honest, I know a couple of ballplayers couldn't pass that test without getting hit in the head. But they have Villarreal ready, and he's been batting over 300 in the minors with a lot of home runs, so he was coming up soon anyway, despite still being shaped like a pregnant mailbox. So, I finally get my first at-bat in the bigs against the Dodgers. It's bottom of the ninth, and we're tied 2-2. The utility infielder playing short ahead of me, Manny Ignacio, a lefty, strikes out 3 times, and they got a left-handed closer pitching. So the skipper needs a righty at the plate. We're playing in Candlestick Park, which, as you know, sits out in a peninsula in San Francisco Bay, and usually has a prevailing 75-mile-an-hour wind. But what I'm not used to is about the ninth inning of every game, the seagulls start coming in, getting ready to swoop down on the uneaten fries and hot dog buns. And they do it like they're psychic, or they can read the scoreboard or something. So it's 2 outs. We got a guy on second with some speed, and I come up, and who is catching but Chava Villarreal. Chava is short for Salvador, which makes about as much sense as a guy named Villarreal that can't pronounce the letter V, even if you put him in a Volvo and drive him to Visalia for Valentine's Day. And he's off.
Hey, man, nice to see you again. How you doing? You get married? You got any kids? How's your mother? You like San Francisco? You been to the mission?
And he goes on and on and on until, between him and the seagulls diving on the outfield beyond the pitcher, I think it's going to be a miracle if I even see the ball, let alone hit it.
And, you like Caribbean food? I take you for the best plantains in the city when you come to Los Angeles.
And the pitcher throws me a hanging curve that moves like a balloon. Time slows down. Villarreal is a mosquito buzzing in another city, and I let go on that son of a bitch. Whole body swing, toes to hips to fingertips, and it has the clack stick sound of a homer. I can feel it, and the crowd can hear it, and they are on their feet. It's going to be a line drive homer. Not high, just a rocket off the field. Except, before it gets off the infield, there's an explosion of feathers. A literal explosion. I'm not even out of the batter's box, and this circular snowstorm of feathers appears right over the second baseman's head. And this bird drops, crushed and limp, and the ball drops, plop. And the second baseman shakes his head like he's got water in his ears, because he was following the ball to go out like the rest of us. But now it's sitting at his feet, and he picks it up and throws me out at first. We go on to win, but my first big league at bat, I kill a bird, and not a seagull or a pigeon, oh no. My line drive killed a friggin' goonie bird, an albatross, like a 5-foot wingspan. I basically knocked a turkey out of the sky with my first hit in the bigs, and the last thing I hear before the ball hits the first baseman's mitt is Villarreal. Oh man, oh shit, I can't believe it, oh man. So that's it, right? I'm cursed. But it turns out I'm not that cursed. And I bat 260 that season, and we get to the National League playoffs, and by next year, I'm starting shortstop. But here's the thing. Villarreal is starting catcher for the Dodgers. And we have to play those sons of bitches 19 times during the season. And 3 or 4 times every game for 19 games, when I come up, that fat fuck is, "So how you doing? You feeling good? I heard you got married. You have any kids? How's your mom?" And between that and the albatross, I get to be almost worthless on offense against the Dodgers. Batting a flat .150 against them when I'm batting in the high 200s, low 300s against everyone else. My third season with the Giants, we're neck and neck with the Dodgers for the division. And the guy I jumped over at Fresno is batting .375 and fielding just as well. So I figure I'm maybe 2-3 bad games from losing my starting position. So when I come up in the second game against the Dodgers, I say, even before I get in the box, "Villarreal, just shut the fuck up. Just shut your fucking mouth while I'm in the box. You hear me?" Evidently, though, he didn't hear me. Because through 3 balls, 4 foul balls, and a swing and a miss, Villarreal jabbered, "I'm sorry, man. I didn't know it bothered you. You want me to shut up? I'll shut up. I'm a pro, man. A batter needs it quiet. I'm quiet. I was just wondering, you know, how your mom was." 2 Dodger games later, right after the ump calls a third strike, which was a gift to the pitcher, because it's like a foot off the plate, I turn around and say, "You cocksucker, you don't shut the fuck up. I'm gonna knock your fucking head off." And the ump says, "You're out of here!" and makes to throw me out of the game. "You can't use language like that," he says, which is more explanation than he has to give. And I say, "I wasn't calling you a cocksucker. I was calling this cocksucker a cocksucker. You ought to throw him out of the game. He's got to drive you nuts, right? He never, never shuts the fuck up." It was a Sunday day game, and there was a lot of kids at the park, and it was televised nationally, and they muted me. But it turns out that people read lips a lot better than you'd think. So the cocksucker, and this time I mean the ump, suspended me for 2 games. And that cocksucker, Villarreal, hit a game-winning homer against us that day. So I think you can see where I'm going with this. That's right. It might not have been the albatross. And every baseball fan in the country thinks I have a black box over my mouth because they can't even play the highlights without I'm calling every granny watching the 6 o'clock news a cocksucker. Every game, it's all I can do not to hit Villarreal in the throat every at-bat. And then, we're coming into the fall, and I get my chance. I'm on second when Joe Rolo smacks one into the gap in center, sending it to the wall. I'm hell on wheels going for home, and their center fielder has a good arm. But the third base coach sends me.